from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, about a couple decades ago, and I'm being generous, when in the one of the early iterations, thank you very much, of this broadcast, I got an angry letter. Well, a huffy letter from a listener, or a soon-to-be former listener, a then soon-to-be former listener, who said, quote, this, and I'm going to bowdlerize the quote just because of the F-word CC, but, quote, this man of a thousand voices crap went out 30 years ago, unquote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it only took him a couple of decades to be right. I'm reeling from some kind of bug that I either got at the Democratic convention, a donkey bug, or on the plane. Hey, how could an airline in bankruptcy not give you fresh air? So we're just going to talk. We're just going to visit today. But although the found objects bin is full to brimming, so we'll check that. But we're just going to visit today because there's so much to talk about. My favorite unintentional irony in the week's news came on the August 3rd edition of the Washington Post, at least in the online edition, when these two stories, these two headlines, were juxtaposed, literally one right after the other. The first one, Messenger launches to investigate Mercury. That's a NASA story. And second, most fish from lakes is too high in mercury. We're sending a spacecraft to investigate Mercury. We got too much of it right here. Let's send ours up there. They like it. They named their planet after it. Oh, they didn't. I forgot. Now, let's spend a moment or two on the fascinating subject of Saddam Hussein's day in court. Remember that last month? Video went around the world. We talked a little bit about how some of it was, here's that word again, bowdlerized. And apparently all the other people who were hauled into that court that day, none of that video surfaced. Because we don't care about them, do we? But the more one reads about that day, the weirder it gets. As if the fog of war had misted up the courtroom windows themselves. For example, from the relentlessly anti-war journalist Robert Fisk. The Americans led Saddam Hussein to believe until he reached the courtroom that he was on his way to his execution. Indeed, when he entered the room, he believed the judge was there to condemn him to death. This, after all, was the way Saddam ran his own state security courts. No wonder he initially looked disoriented because of how he was prepared. Which is why Saddam asked the judge, Judge Juhai, are you a lawyer? Is this a trial? And swiftly as he realized that it really was a court hearing and not a preliminary to his own hanging, he quickly adopted an attitude of belligerence. We're not going to learn much more about Saddam's future court appearances. Salam Chalabi, the brother of Ahmad and the man entrusted by the Americans with the tribunal, told the Iraqi press 2 weeks ago that all media would be excluded from future court hearings. That judge, Juhi, I don't speak Arabic. Is that clear by now? Gave an interview to the New York Times on Saturday in which he bragged about the value to the nascent Iraqi state of seeing a public court proceeding. He expects at least a year before any of the accused comes to trial. And that long before any of them would be seen again. Mr. Juhai said what mattered was not what would happen to Hussein, but that the first crucial step, placing him before a court, had been taken. We have started the case against him, and we'll finish it, he said. Really? The special tribunal designed to try Saddam Hussein was unable to host his first appearance because it was not ready, creating doubt over its ability to perform the task, according to officials and lawyers. The toppled dictator was instead hauled before a regular Iraqi court, presided over by the aforementioned Judge Juhai. Delays in appointing judges, coupled with the hasty transfer of power to the interim Iraqi government, were the main reasons why the Iraqi Special Tribunal, run by Salem Chalabi, missed its date with Saddam. Chalabi tried to play down the significance of the glitch. He insisted that the IST, created by the U.S.-led coalition, was ultimately in charge of the proceedings. Saddam's case, in the meantime, is in the hands of the Central Criminal Court of Iraq, also created by the coalition, but operating under the normal Iraqi judicial code, lacking the exceptional powers of the special tribunal to hear cases involving charges such as crimes against humanity. Saddam's status as a prisoner of war expired with the end of the occupation. A judge's order was required to keep him in detention. The tribunal was unable to provide one, as it had not appointed a set of 9 appellate judges who were needed for the organ to function fully. That's why the Central Court became involved, according to the U.S., a U.S. advisor. The judges must be in place before an investigative judge can begin proceedings, the advisor said, on condition of anonymity. Chalabi insists the ex-president and the ringleaders will be transferred to the authority of the special tribunal in the coming days. The story is dated July 7th. We're still waiting, Salem. We are running the process, Chalabi told the French news agency, adding that the young-looking investigating judge from the Central Court who oversaw the first hearing would move to the special tribunal as one of its new appointees. At the same time, no one could say when an announcement of the new judge appointments will be made, or when and how the high-profile cases will be transferred. According to the statute creating the special tribunal, the new judges could include non-Iraqis. Hey, my mom always said I could be a lawyer. Right now, we're in the darkness. We don't understand what is going on, says Badi Arif Izzat, a veteran lawyer. All the hearings were illegal, explaining the new courts were not a legitimate part of the Iraqi judicial system. A judge at the Central Court had doubts about the special tribunal. Quote, any crime could be tried in an ordinary court. The word special makes all Iraqi people nervous and angry. And finally, as if all that's not enough, a senior Iraqi judge investigating the murder of a finance ministry official has issued a warrant for the arrest of Salem Chalabi. He's been accused of threatening to kill the official just before the official was in fact shot at the door of his home in May. The official was conducting inquiries into the property holdings of the Chalabi family when he was killed. That's what we call in the business a coincidence. Hello, welcome to the show.
Jacks are in the boxes, and the clowns are all gone to bed. You can hear happiness staggering on down the street, footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merry. Room is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping, somewhere a king has no wife, and the wind cries. Traffic lights turn blue tomorrow, shine the emptiness down on my bed. The tiny island, it sags down the street, cause the light that they leave there, and the wind screams Mary. We'll be right back. remember the names that has blown in the past. But it's crutch, it's old age, it's wisdom. But you know this will be the last. And the wind cries, Mary.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this chatty edition of Le Show. First in the Found Objects file this week, President Bush. I was driving around. I have satellite radio in my car, so I was hearing this on CNN. And it's lucky there are so few pedestrians in Los Angeles, because they would have had to scatter at the moment I heard this. And yet, none of the journalists or others in the audience apparently reacted when President Bush said this on Thursday.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
No, nor should we. Asked for a comment, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said Bush's statement, quote, just shows even the most straightforward and plain-spoken people misspeak, unquote. He didn't say sometimes. Yeah, he's plain-spoken. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a big week for the admission of accounting, shall we say, errors? Should we be nice, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, and just call them kind of accounting malfunctions? That would be the word. Bristol-Myers Squibb is paying $100 million range of a fine without admitting they did anything wrong. You know, just a good faith fine for accounting irregularities. Halliburton is paying $7.5 million as a good faith fine, GFF, for accounting irregularities. And the Securities and Exchange Commission went out of its way to say that the CEO of Halliburton at the time, Dick Cheney, didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anything about the change in accounting procedures which allowed Halliburton to inflate its profit performance. He didn't know about that. CEOs in the 90s didn't care about doing anything possible to make their company look more profitable, did they now? But one might call one's attention to another interesting fact. Some time ago, the vice president opposed the creation of a director of national intelligence, I believe when he was a defense secretary under Bush 1. The vice president's spokesman, Kevin Kellams, says Cheney does not discuss his conversations with the president and cautioned against comparing current and historical positions. He's part of history. What he used to think isn't background, it's history. Literally. I mean, the way Americans say it. And yet, this week we were told that the justification for the terror alert was, despite the fact, as the New York Times and Washington Post reported, that the information was 3 years old, most of the information, that, hey, Al-Qaeda works that way. They're patient. They plan for a long time. Here from her testimony before the 9/11 Commission, Condoleezza Rice, asked about the presidential daily briefing of August 6, 2001, warning of Al-Qaeda planning to attack America. You asked me, she says, whether it or not it warned of attacks. A questioner says, I asked you what the title was. Rice said, did it not warn of attacks? It did not warn of attacks inside the United States. It was historical information based on old reporting. Note to listener, the reporting was 3 to 4 years old. See how much trouble you can get into when you compare current and historical positions? Okay, I stopped winking. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. From Advertising Age, the Quran of the advertising and marketing industries, the U.S. Army needs a few good ideas. I'll read it for you till I run out of voice. The U.S. Army needs a few good ideas. Its advertising account, worth about $200 million, is in review. And an online request for proposals tells agencies that, quote, the Army is busier than ever and at war. That's just in. For 5 years, the Army has used the tagline, Army of One. But now observers say the slogan in the current TV campaign that pushes job skills and war gadgetry is out of touch with the reality of war and should be scrapped. Quote, the Army has to be careful because it really damages morale if they do a bait and switch, says Evan Wright, who was embedded with the Marines' 1st Reconnaissance Battalion in Iraq. The Army sells kids on the idea of playing with really cool guns, machines, tanks, radios, and computers that they will have so much high technology they'll be an army of one, Wright said. But the dominant images of the war are burning Army Humvees in the field. The technology doesn't seem so cool. The Army unit Wright followed in Afghanistan as a Rolling Stone reporter hated the Army of One campaign. They were embarrassed by it. A spokesman for the Army said it'll keep that slogan. We will obviously be looking at a new contractor, but there's no plan at this time to do anything to change the logo, the theme of our advertising. There's no plan at this time with metaphysical certitude, says Army spokesman Paul Boyce, who obviously watches the McLaughlin Group. But the Army campaign may be in danger of breaking the brand promise, one of the mortal sins of advertising. Quote, whoever picks up the Army's new account will have their work cut out for them, says Jim Tice, senior reporter for Army Times. Not only will they have to sell the service in a time of war, but also a time in which the Army is significantly increasing its size, so there are a lot of question marks, and people are very antsy about this. What's happening right now is that a lot of people who are coming into military service are thrilled by the idea of war, Mr. Tice said. It's an adventure thing. The advertising is beginning to subtly reflect that. Certainly, going after college money is important. Yeah, ask Lindy England. Let's get back to the story now, but less so over the past several years. The Army has started to make use of video games in its promotional efforts and is now selling a game called America's Army. The fact that the Army is now selling a video game is perfect, says journalist Mr. Wright. Since video games are all about killing, it's basically saying, play the ultimate video game. Join the Army. First-person shooter. Sign here. And also from Advertising Age, office email used to market political views to employees. What's that about? Harry, would you read that for us? Yes, I will. I was speaking in your voice, ladies and gentlemen, because mine is crap. ExxonMobil, PPG Industries, Caterpillar, Household International, and half the Fortune 100 corporations have signed on with a program that pushes their company's views of political candidates to employees via inter-office emails. The Business Industry Political Action Committee's Prosperity Project targets 20 million employees in battleground states. The committee is especially concerned about confirmation of pro-business judges. Greg Casey, president and CEO of BIPAC, says the group does not tell employees to vote for a particular candidate. We tell businesses, don't tell employees how to vote. Tell them how the issues impact them. Like, if you don't vote for this guy, you'll be fired. No, he didn't say that. A person's employer is the single most credible source of job-related information, Mr. Casey said, adding that, quote, there is an affinity between working folks and their employer, unquote. I trust him. He seems to know his way around the real world. Companies using the program generally offer websites with candidate voting records on key business issues. Some go further with email alerts, offering further details and urging employees to vote. Not everyone agrees with this method of political lobbying, says Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy. Such arm-twisting to generate support for their favorite candidates and the costs which occur at shareholder expense needs to be brought up at public shareholder meetings. Casey says he finds it ironic that someone who promotes democracy is concerned about his group's activities. Quote, it's democracy at its finest. It's the epitome of putting people back in politics. He says while employers are unlikely to be effective talking about Iraq, they can be far more effective in discussing major domestic issues such as the economy and health care. Under Federal Elections Commission regulations, employers can give formal endorsements only to management and stockholders. Casey said BIPAC's activities are helped by increasing employee stock ownership. See how it works? The world is a nuttier place, one discovers when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature.
Well, now, how come right this day? Good and you I feel real good, don't you bad? Little taking puts me right in the mood. I do me wrong sometimes, the best time I ever had.
This is LeShow, and we go now to the found object file through sources, of course, I can't name. What are you talking about? And we go to the home of NBC Nightly News, which in recent weeks has lost its longtime ratings leadership in the Nightly News Derby to ABC with Peter Jennings. Now, the question arises, is this because Tom Brokaw was on vacation, wasn't anchoring the Nightly News, or is something else afoot? Late this week, Tom returned to the anchor chair, ready for battle.
Change your jacket.
Hmm?
Change your jacket.
A little more serious. Serious stuff.
All right, let's find out just how serious. First of all, the markets. Now, that's always an important story, especially so this week. Here's how Tom handled it on Friday.
For the week, NASDAQ was down more than 110 points, almost 8% of its value. I had NASDAQ wrong. It's down 6%. Yeah. Here, I'll just do NASDAQ was down more than 100, almost, I'll do that whole line. NASDAQ was down more than 110 points, almost 6% of its value.
The first version was heard on the East Coast. The correct version was heard in the Midwest. In the West Coast. Most of the Midwest carries the East Coast version. They didn't run a correction in the East Coast version. He just redid it for the West. Serious stuff. But the real serious stuff, as you know, according to my theory, the explanation for the ratings dominance of Nightly News in the last historical period is the number of times during the broadcast that Tom manages to work the word tonight into the broadcast. So here is the latest Tom Tonight count as he girds for battle with Peter Jennings.
Good evening. Jobs are a big issue in this presidential election campaign, and tonight, a small number is getting major attention. That story from NBC's David Gregory tonight. It's also been a week of important developments on the terror front, and tonight there is more to report, including new criminal charges involving an internet scheme to raise money for terrorists. That story and the latest on the terrorist money trail tonight from NBC's Pete Williams. Tonight, in Defending America, How Safe, How Soon, senior investigative correspondent Lisa Myers talks exclusively to one of the men under suspicion. Up next, NBC News in Depth tonight, the latest campaign ad from an independent political group. NBC News in Depth tonight, a harsh political ad attacking Senator John Kerry's Vietnam War record is putting the spotlight back on the independent organizations, which are called 527s. And as NBC's Andrea Mitchell tells us tonight, the campaign finance law that was supposed to fix the system left this very big loophole. Iraq Watch tonight, there was more fierce fighting today between U.S. and Iraqi forces and Shiite fighters. In this country, one of the primary issues of the presidential campaign will be the American health care system. Tonight, preview of an hour-long report that I've done centering on one of the uninsured victims of the Staten Island ferry crash here in New York. Tonight on Dateline, more about what happens to him and to the doctors and healthcare professionals who are also caught in this financial squeeze. It's called Critical Condition. Tom Brokaw reports tonight. That's Nightly News for this Friday. I'm Tom Brokaw. I'll see you later tonight on Dateline for our special report on the healthcare crisis, Critical Condition.
Total number of tonight's 13. It's not his historical high, but you know what trouble we get into comparing present tonight totals with historical tonight totals. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies and near apologies of the week.
We're almost sorry.
Here's somebody who was almost sorry. Republican Representative Catherine Harris. Yes, she was Florida's Secretary of State back in 2000. She's not apologizing for that. She says this week she regrets making the claim that a plot existed to blow up the power grid in Carmel, Indiana, a notion disputed by city officials. The Florida lawmaker stands by her statement that based on classified information, the United States has thwarted more than 100 potential terrorist attacks. Now to real apologies. Roger Clemens was given an emphatic apology for unjustly being ejected from his 10-year-old son's baseball game last weekend in Colorado. David King, president of tournament organizer Triple Crown Sports, said Mr. Clemens was a non-aggressor and a victim of mistaken identity and confusion by an upset umpire. He was asked to leave son Casey's game Saturday when a 22-year-old ump said the Houston Astros pitcher spit a sunflower seed at him. Mr. Clemens never raised his voice, never physically confronted our official, nor was he ever on the field of play, King said. Mr. Clemens was unjustly asked to leave the field of play for all of this. We apologize to Mr. Clemens. Jamaican dancehall star Beanie Man has apologized for offending people with his lyrics, which critics say incite violence against homosexuals. In a statement issued through his record company, Virgin, the 30-year-old performer said he had realized that certain lyrics and recordings I've made in the past may have caused distress and outrage among people whose identities and lifestyles are different from my own. I offer my sincerest apologies to those who might have been offended, threatened, or hurt by my songs. Dateline Valparaiso, Indiana, correct pronunciation. A 46-year-old man who wanted to let a judge know he was unhappy found out that writing obscenities on court documents may not have been the best way to do so. Jeffrey Gast is serving a week in jail after being cited for contempt of court. He wrote obscene messages to a judge across four legal documents and mailed the paperwork back to the court. He appeared in court later without an attorney. He apologized and said he didn't intend to attack the court. A group of Iraqis visiting Memphis were robbed at gunpoint on a downtown Memphis street. This past week, the delegation first made headlines when they were banned from City Hall because Memphis officials considered them a security risk. City Council Chairman Joe Brown, who barred the delegation from entering City Hall, apologized along with 11 other members of the council in a written letter Wednesday. The letter asked the Iraqis for forgiveness and noted the embarrassment the council had brought upon itself. In nearby Elizabethton, Tennessee, an emergency management agency director's attempt to stage a realistic drill shocked people attending a county commission meeting. Commissioners had just convened when a man and a woman rushed in carrying guns, held a weapon to the head of the county finance director, and said there would be no new taxes. One of the people acting as a hostage taker fired a blank. The finance director said he didn't know what was happening. The sheriff wasn't clued in either, and city police responded when someone called 911. Elizabethton Emergency Management Agency Director Ernest Jackson planned the drill and had told some people coming into the meeting that there would be one, but didn't say what kind. He apologized to second commissioners and audience members. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder this week delivered a passionate apology to Poland for the immeasurable suffering its people faced after they attempted a two-month stand against Nazi occupiers six decades ago. He said he was honored to be a guest of Warsaw. His presence at the Warsaw commemorations, which was also attended by Colin Powell and other foreign leaders, was seen as a significant step in the reconciliation process between the two former enemies. Schroeder was under great pressure to raise the issue, and in a long-awaited proclamation, he tried to reassure Poles that his government would not back the demands of deportees, Germans who lost their property when they were expelled from Poland at the end of the war. German government will oppose such claims and make that plain before any international court, he said. The director of the Waimea Valley Audubon Center this week apologized for the killing of park peacocks by archers last week, a move to control the population of birds that had become a nuisance to people and plants in the park. Diana King said the park will look for better ways to manage the peacock population. It was a tragic mistake, and it won't be repeated, King told the Honolulu Advertiser. Olympic Games organizers apologized this week and launched an investigation into allegations a Mexican television crew was beaten by guards after attempting to film outside the Olympic Games port of Piraeus. The crew say they were pushed into an unmarked car by three security officers as they tried to film outside the port that will host Olympic cruise ships. They said they were taken to a police gymnasium and beaten. "We strongly regret what happened yesterday," Games spokesman Michael Zararatos told reporters, while not confirming any of the details given by the Mexicans. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, also back in Hawaii, state education officials have adjusted test scores for third graders who took statewide achievement tests earlier this year. The adjustments were made because of errors in two of the questions on the Hawaii state assessment that students took in March and April. The company that developed the test, Texas-based Harcourt Assessment, apologized for the errors. Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. You know what? I think I'm going to copyright that feature.
Babies from Manhattan will be leaving Harlem if they can. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
When Hollywood goes black and tan, Louis Armstrong with his trumpet will be heading westward with his band. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
When Hollywood goes black and tan, Harlem crooners with a swing will be singing at the studio. Makes no difference if you can't sing, just say, heed, heed, hide the hole. When they start to swing that rhythm, I'll be heading for that promised land. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
You won't find them wanging, bucking. Everybody will be trucking. It's gonna be grand when Hollywood goes black and tan. Those boys are helping hand. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
When Hollywood goes black and tan, old Bob Howard made a promise to latch on to that baby grand. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
When Hollywood goes black and tan, Step and Fetch is gonna sing and dance like Fred Astaire. Nina May don't have to sing, cause she can be petite like Anna Claire. Water's gonna do a fan dance and shake those feathers off a fan. Yeah, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
Here's good news and it's the newest. Braddock's going to meet Joe Louis. It's gonna be grand when Hollywood goes back and tan.
This is Le Show, and we have news of the new Iraq. They're learning democracy the old-fashioned way. Iraq's interim government has closed the Baghdad office of Al Jazeera television network for 1 month, citing national security concerns. This decision was taken to protect the people of Iraq and the interests of Iraq, Prime Minister Ayad Alawi told a news conference. I guess Al Jazeera wasn't allowed to cover. He said the order to close Al Jazeera was to take effect immediately, came after an independent commission monitored the network's reports. The findings of the commission were compelling, he said. Said Interior Minister Falah al-Nakib, when asked why he got an order to close Al Jazeera, "You know exactly what the network has been doing. They've been showing a lot of crime and criminals on TV. Gee. Let's close down channels 2, 4, 7, 5, 9, and 11 while we're at it. I mean here. They have transferred a bad picture about Iraq and about Iraqis," al-Nakib said. This isn't the first time Al Jazeera has been closed down. The Coalition Provisional Authority, hey, that's us, and our friends, closed down Al Jazeera in January for showing disrespect to prominent Iraqis. Are they learning from somebody? The Republican Party in America has barred a British Labour member of parliament from the floor of its convention on the ground that he is not sufficiently conservative. Alan Williams, a veteran Welsh MP, said the same problem had occurred 4 years ago at the previous GOP convention, although a last-minute deal then had given him access to the floor. Last night, he said, "No compromise has been possible this time. We are far from pleased," he said, speaking, I guess, in the Welsh we. I find it singularly strange that Labor MPs can be welcome on the floor of Congress, but not at the Republican convention. They said they didn't want any politician who wasn't a conservative on the floor of the convention center. A Republican Party spokesman said no slight had been intended, and that the issue had merely revolved around the need to keep numbers on the floor of the convention down. And President Bush's reelection campaign insisted on knowing the race of an Arizona Daily Star journalist assigned to photograph Vice President Dick Cheney. The Star refused to provide any information. A rally organizer for the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign asked Terry Haight, the Star's managing editor, to disclose the journalist's race on Friday. After Haight refused, the organizer called back and said the journalist probably would be allowed to photograph the vice president. It was such an outrageous request, I was personally insulted, Haight said later. I guess that would be a hate crime, if it weren't so amusing. So who are the Iraqis learning from about this democracy thing? President Bush challenged John Kerry this week to give a yes or no answer on Iraq. Bush said, knowing what I know now, I would still have invaded Iraq. Rising to the challenge, Kerry said Friday, well, yeah, but I might have waited. What he really said was, by now, I would have invaded to topple Saddam, too. So no wonder they were spending the week arguing about Vietnam. And a who's who of Australia's former military chiefs, departmental heads, and top diplomats is launching a scathing attack on the government's foreign policy, calling for truth in government. A statement from more than 40 ex-military and diplomatic officials will condemn Australia's commitment to the Iraq invasion as based on deception and call for Australia to stop rubber stamping American policies. What kind of stamp would they like? Two former chiefs of the Australian Defense Force, two former Navy chiefs, and a former Air Force chief. Ex-heads of mission have represented Australia in all the major posts, including the United States, China, Japan, and Indonesia, as well as in Middle Eastern countries. The statement will be a blow to the Prime Minister. And unlike certain other heads of state, he is not reputed to like blow. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a call for civility, increased civility in the nation's discourse. We're not going to get it from the politicians. I'll tell you where we're going to get it. From the finalists at the Miss Mississippi Beauty Pageant.
This year we invited the public to provide the onstage questions, and these questions were submitted to our website, missmississippi.org. So let's get started right now. And our first of the five finalists is Miss Metro Jackson, Jalen Wood. Hi, Jalen.
Hey.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This one came in from Christopher in Illinois. As obsessed as Americans seem to be with diets and dieting, how do you account for the high rate of obesity in this country?
I think it's our sedentary lifestyle. We sit in front of the television, we don't have any activity, and if we'll just get outside and be outdoors, which is what I love to do, and be active, then we can help our physical shape.
Jalen Wood, thank you very much. And our second finalist is Miss Byram Tri-County, Angela Allen. This was sent in by Kieran from Rhode Island. What do you like most and least about living in Mississippi?
Well, not many people know about Mississippi and the talent we have to offer, and that us Southern girls are very beautiful. That's one thing that I like the most about Mississippi, is look at all these beautiful girls. Also in Mississippi, like I said, not too many people know about the talented young women of our state. And I think in order to get people to notice that, we should have something like this.
Angela Allen, thank you very much. I'll give you the question. You can keep it. There you go, for your scrapbook. All right, our third finalist is Miss Vicksburg, Melanie Sanders. All right, Melanie. This one is sent in by Betsy from Minnesota. All right. What do you consider to be the characteristics of a great leader?
Well, I think that a great leader needs to possess integrity and honesty. I think that one thing that a lot of leaders need to always remember is that when you have integrity, you have everything, and people will gain respect for you and they'll gain trust for you. And I think that's very important with any leader on any capacity.
Melanie Sanders, thank you very much. And let's see, our fourth finalist is Miss Magnolia, Kristen Dambrino. Hey, Kristen, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Very good. Sent in by Blake, from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Do you think that reality TV programs such as Survivor and American Idol provide healthy entertainment or a skewed view of our society?
First of all, I don't believe they're real. I don't ever really watch them, really. I prefer to watch AMC or Turner Classic Movies. I guess I've got kind of an old soul, but I don't really believe they're real entertainment. I believe they're a waste of time, but that's just my opinion. Thank you.
Call it like it is, Kristen Dambrino. And last but certainly not least is Miss Dixieland, Taryn Fauché. All right, Taryn, this is from Nancy in California, all right? If you had the opportunity to speak with entertainment executives about their movies and TV programs, what would you tell them?
I wouldn't tell them anything. I would beg them to provide us more quality entertainment for our children. Violence is rampant in our movies, and sexual activities are not appropriate for children. Even the PG-13 movies are no longer appropriate for children of 13 years of age. And I would beg them to give us more quality entertainment for our young life.
Taryn Fauché, excellent answers. Let's give them all a big hand.
Finally, ladies and gentlemen, this week, we in this country have this odd impression of the Brits as proper, polite, but Eastern Europeans are getting a different impression. first in Prague, where I saw him last summer, and now in Estonia, of all places. So-called lager louts, young single British males in search of cheap beer, are conducting 10 beer pub crawls, totty tours, and visiting medieval lesbian strip shows. Bar owners say many British visitors prefer to drink themselves into a stupor and make lewd suggestions to the local girls or take their clothes off and run around naked. Jason Barry, an English expatriate who runs a tourist agency, says we've had a boom in low expectation tourism, i.e. people who don't want to visit any historical sites or see anything except a bar. It's beginning, he says, to get irresponsible. Says an Australian who owns the bar with no name in the capital of Estonia, Tallinn, in the old town. Business is good. Most of them just want a drink. I must admit it doesn't look good when you've got a row of 20 asses pushed against your front window. Says a Estonian tourist board official, we would prefer tourists who stayed longer and spent more money. Sometimes stag weekenders book up the spaces on the planes and other tourists can't come. In a cleanup attempt, officials of the Estonia's capital, they're going to Estonia, ladies and gentlemen, in search for, well, you'll find out what they're in search of in a moment. Officials of Tallinn recently closed all the brothels, including one called Infant. One group from South London said the city's lewd charms had been exaggerated. They would not return. Another added, I came because I wanted filth. We're not getting filth. On a possibly related story, British drinking water is now reported to be contaminated with traces of Prozac, suggesting that doctors are overprescribing. Or if you ask the people in Tallinn, they're underprescribing. Ladies and gentlemen, I've run out of lozenges and out of airtime. That's good timing. That concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time, over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, around the world via your computer, on the internet, at two different locations, live and archive, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And now available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. It'd be just like having full vocal authority and the man of the thousand voices crap coming back if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. That's how I found out that it's not pronounced Chador, it's pronounced Shador. Shador, everybody. The show internet services by Steve Mack. The show playlists usually available at the beautifully refurbished harryshearer.com. Thanks to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks for their contributions to today's broadcast. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.